Yo, what's up, everybody? It's the fourth day of Kwanzaa.
Abari Ghani, bitches.
Hell yeah.
it's Ujamaa.
It's Ujamaa,
our favorite,
yeah.
Cooperative economics.
Yeah, and that's very fitting for this podcast. Real Sankara Hours, your favorite Pan-African socialist political podcast where we talk about politics, current events, race, culture, shit like that from a Pan-African Marxist lens. Housekeeping, normally, if you want to support this podcast, donate $5 a month to be a patron where you get bonus episodes. So patreon.com/realsankarahours. Again, that's patreon.com/realsankarahours. $5 a month gets you bonus episodes, and for our last bonus episode, we read
We're reading Marcus Garvey, so get on board, guys.
So that's what we're going to be reading. Others we've read, Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, which actually is going to be very relevant for this episode. So yeah, $5 a month gets you bonus episodes. You can also donate, contribute $3 a month just to support the podcast. So yeah, patreon.com/realsankarahours. Also follow us on Twitter at Sankara Hours. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Oh, also, before I forget, we just created a Discord server, so I'm gonna put that in the show notes from now on. But yeah, as of right now, we have a Discord server, so I'll put the link in the show notes. So that's to kind of, you know, create a little community for people who follow us, and also it'll be good, like, if you have any kind of like feedback, or like if there's technical issues, you can address them in the Discord server. So
yes, that's where you want to complain about the audio levels. Don't comment on the post, guys. Don't message me on Patreon. Complain about the audio levels on the Discord that yeah. I don't check, but we'll start checking.
We have a Discord server, so if there's any like tech issues, stuff like that.
I guess ask questions.
Yeah, and also like, yeah, bring up, you know, create a community, talk about the episodes, and also like I think it'd be good for on our end, you know, for you guys to share stuff that would give us ideas for stuff we can talk about in future episodes as well. So yeah, it's a place where you can talk about the episodes, issues, you know, have like real, you know, deep discussions, shit like that. So yeah, so we have a Discord server that'll be in the show notes. And oh yeah, I'm Adam Hudson. Follow me at AdamHudson5 on Twitter, which is now run by fucking Elon Musk.
Not for long, I think. Isn't he stepping down?
How much more
can he run this shit into the ground? This is Peter M. Gunn. Follow me at M. Gunn Peter. Though I don't really tweet, but you know, this is the post Christmas episode. Neither of us really did anything. You know, Christmas is not really a well. I like Columbus got dumped on, and it'd be a long drive to the rest of my family anyway, so I was just not gonna go anywhere. And yeah, man, I gotta tell you, like, Adam doesn't deal with this because he's like never seen snow because he lives in California.
Outside of California, so,
yes,
but yeah, never.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, never.
But Columbus, you know, they spend $330 million on the police, and you'd think they could at least take a little bit of that to buy some more fucking snow plows. It's honestly disgraceful. The state the roads were in for like 2 days. I mean, like the storm hit like on the 22nd, I think, like the night of that, and like by the 24th, like the main interstates were still like complete ice, and like everyone was just wiping out. And like I hate being one of those people, but like Columbus is definitely a city where nobody knows how to drive, I think, because everyone has to drive everywhere all the time, so don't really think about it. I feel like I stopped learning how to drive when I came back here, but it's even worse. Like, they really don't know how to drive in the snow. But hey, at least it's not Buffalo, which like got put under fucking, like they called in the National Guard, and I was just like, it's definitely something we're gonna come back to, because I was like, this is, first of all, yeah, definitely like, we are in the climate catastrophe neo-fascist state. Like, that was proof, because it's like, they've got the resources to send in the National Guard to a majority black city. Look at that. A disinvested majority black city, Rust Belt city, to make sure nobody drives. But, like, I don't know. They, like, you know, they just were, but they accepted that, like, you know, people are going to freeze to death. So that's, I mean, that's where we are now. Like, we're here. So people, so, you know, I guess if it makes you feel better, you don't have to worry about impending doom, because, like, we're in it. Like,
yeah.
So, so yeah, happy fucking holidays, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, today is December 29th, 2022. So, yes, post-Christmas, and this is the last episode of ours of 2022, and
the second, yeah, and last.
Yeah. yeah, I didn't really do shit. I mean, this is the first Christmas without my mom, so Merry Christmas to those for whom Christmas is not so merry. That was pretty much my vibe for Christmas. Is that
like, I think I will say one thing I like about millennials is that, like, the, we're starting to recognize that the Christmas spirit itself might just be toxic positivity, and that, like, maybe, and that, like, the depressed people get to, like, be more empowered these days, because, like, it is, yeah, it's fucking rough. Like, it is, aside from the commercial or whatever, like, the hollowness of whatever the message is supposed to be, just the idea that, like, there is the Christmas spirit and cheer that you are supposed to feel, and, like, I don't know, like, really, once I, like, discovered Santa wasn't real, when I don't think I ever really believed in Santa, like, Christmas, like, other than the 10 minutes when opening presents, I'm like, this is it, I don't know. It's something that I just always felt was, like, a hollow experience. And so I'm glad that I don't have to pretend to be happy about it these days. And I don't think it was a great Christmas for anyone, especially Southwest Airlines. Holy shit. But, you know, I think there's a utility in just, like, recognizing that, I don't know, like, everything kind of sucks now, so maybe the holidays, yeah, like, you know, whatever. If you're a Christmas freak, like, and you listen to this podcast, you know, don't get mad at us, but
no,
that's cool that you like Christmas, but, like, I just think people should interrogate, I don't know, it's like the, like, it is the thing, like, really its function is to, like, clear the inventory of consumer goods, like, yeah, it like, that is the point of it at this point, so,
right,
yeah, I don't know, like, sorry for being materialist about Christmas, but, you know,
also,
what,
also, like, I'm starting to appreciate Kwanzaa a lot more. Like, I'm probably willing to say on this podcast that I prefer Kwanzaa over Christmas, because, I mean, yeah, there's some shit with Karenga, and, you know, and here's the thing, when people say, oh, Kwanzaa's a fake holiday, like, oh, like, all the other ones, like, what's Thanksgiving,
all holidays are made up, guys, they're made up by people,
right,
they didn't, like, exist before humans decided to celebrate them,
and yeah, there's some, you know, Karenga's a shady character, but
yeah, what, well, yeah, think, I mean, you can go back to the episode we did on it 2 years ago,
Yeah, but the principles of Kwanzaa, I think, are very good principles that transcend any particular individual associated with.
Yeah, quantum. Yeah, they're great ideas. So, and
yeah, so.
I wish it was able to make the leap from, like, community theater level, like, stuff to, like, you know, a real, like, lit thing. Fox News was, I watched Fox News at the gym, and they were making fun of, because I guess Pete Buttigieg wished people a happy Kwanzaa in the midst of all the flight shutdowns. So, like, is that really what people want to hear? It's still a joke to those people. And, yeah, I mean, at least it, like, stands for something. Christmas doesn't, like, fucking stand for anything at this point. You know, Jesus wasn't even born in December, guys. So, anyway, all right, enough Grinchiness. Enough real Grinch out, Grinch Sankara hours. The onto the main topic of discussion.
Yeah, so there is recently, 2 weeks ago, the U.S.-Africa summit. So the U.S. held this summit with African leaders to talk about, like, how the U.S. wants to partner with Africa now. And there was actually this speech by Mayor Eric Adams of New York City. I think it's right around the time of the summit. And it was like, basically his point was that he was highlighting, like, black representation in politics and, like, how that can be used in partnership with Africa. And I thought it was, like, a very clever way of someone like Eric Adams to co-opt some of the lingo of Pan-Africanism and black power for, like, quote-unquote, like, liberal representation within the American political system. And one of the things that was, like, on that the U.S. wanted to address with, like, the U.S.-Africa summit is engagement with basically the African diaspora in the U.S. in partnership with African countries. And I'll talk about that, and then we could talk about, like, the sense we got of, like, the reactions from Africans on the continent. But I want to bring up the diaspora part because this is something that I think it's worth being wary of in that. Okay, so the African Union declared the African diaspora its sixth region. So the African Union has five regions on the continent, and then the sixth region is the diaspora. So the other five are North Africa, East Africa, West Africa, Central Africa, and Southern Africa. Those are the five regions of the African continent. Then the African diaspora, which is any person of African descent, African ancestry, living outside of the African continent. And the African diaspora, I would say you can pretty much split it into two micro diasporas, I guess, or two waves of quote unquote migration outside of the African continent. And so there's the more recent diaspora, which are African immigrants living outside of Africa, either in the U.S., Canada, or Europe or elsewhere, right? So, like, these are people who are, like, very recent immigrants out of Africa living outside of the African continent, usually in the West, usually, like, U.S., Canada, like, North America and Europe. And then the other diaspora are the descendants of enslaved Africans who were forcibly taken from Africa 400 to 500 years ago and brought over to the Americas. So African Americans, Jamaicans, Haitians, Afro-Latinos, any person who's a descendant of enslaved Africans to the Americas. So I mentioned the Eric Adams speech because what I thought was kind of concerned me about it was the U.S. potentially using the diaspora for U.S. interest in Africa, because the president of Ghana, like, there was in 2019, there was a year of return. Like, so a lot of African-Americans, Jamaicans, going to Africa and for, you know, the year of return. And I think, like, the U.S. has been catching wind of this, that there's, like, kind of like this kind of burgeoning movement within Black America to learn more of our history, our ties to Africa. So there are more African-Americans, Jamaicans, African diasporans going to Africa and visiting, and you know, it's touristy shit, but there's some who, like, you know, many, I say, who really want to connect with Africa. And also there are local kind of Africans who want to build with diasporans, because we're still the same people. So, and so what concerned me, what Eric Adams was saying, was that it, to me, it seemed like, okay, like, is this for the collective interest of African people globally, or is this being weaponized to use identity politics and weaponize the rhetoric of Pan-Africanism to further U.S. interests in Africa? So I wanted to mention that because, like, that's something that, like, really caught my attention in a not so good way. But yeah, let's talk about the, actually, Peter,
well, as you said that, I was thinking about how the military, like, and the State Department, like, has a pretty good history of, like, recruiting Black Americans to do neocolonialism when, like, in Africa, as part of its policy. And so that's always been part of it. And also, like, Eric Adams, the crypto mayor. there is definitely, I mean, it is interesting because I think the identity crisis going on is, like, the ADOS, Foundational Black Americans versus, I guess, you know, you could say refugees from colonialism, sort of split or whatever, as opposed to, like, the previous understanding that everyone was Black. And there is a sense where, like, maybe a new identity has to be figured out, you know, and of course, we're not ready to talk about new African nationalism, certainly not, like, in the Democratic Party context. But it is, there is an implicit acknowledgement that, like, you know, as long as there are Black people in America, like, there's going to be a connection to Africa. Like, there's never going to be a complete, severing, disassociation. And I think sometimes maybe idiots in the foreign policy sphere think that's, like, an edge America has in, like, dealing with Africa and its interests, you know? Yeah. I mean, really the main point, because this is the first summit in 8 years. There was one in 2014. Of course, Trump not going to do anything like that. But Biden, you know, Rhodesian vibes Joe, who he just loves Africa. Of course. And of course, he's going to make sure that, like, he's all in with Africa. See, this is what I find interesting, is there's a slight rhetorical shift of, like, not of publicly not just talking about Africa as this giant vessel of need, and this, you know, and maybe some tacit acknowledgement that, like, the West is the cause of these problems. But either way, like, there's just all these problems and we just need to do what we can to, you know, solve them without actually doing industrial development, because that's not in America's interest. You know, now we're at a point where, like, African heads of state feel more confident in courting other countries for investment infrastructure who don't have, Like the leading thinking, you know, in the post-colonial era in American foreign policy sphere or whatever, is, like, you can't just build shit if it's a corrupt head of state, because then they'll just take all the money. And so you have to establish, you know, strong democratic structures, and, you know, we'll write your constitution and show you how, just like America. Rule of law, you know, that stuff, and you have to have strong institutions first, and then you get to develop economically. And China and Russia are like, I mean, you know, that's like your internal affairs are your business, but like, yeah, we can do business on building infrastructure that you need. And that's like who's been doing most of the building. It's not America. Like, it's not the IMF. They've been fucking doing just debt traps to, and like, yeah, leading, forcing austerity on these countries, really mob style. Like, the IMF is like the international mafia. And, you know, what they want, what every, you know, corrupt or non-corrupt or whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, what the continent needs is infrastructure. And, you know, there seems to be more gestures towards that. But, like, I don't know, if you look at, you know, what the outlay is for the investment that's committed, it's not towards, it's still towards, like, humanitarian food aid and health infrastructure, which is good, but, like, is also, you know, kind of Bill Gates shit, that kind of stuff. Like, it's still NGO shit and strengthening civic institutions, quote unquote, and not about, like, developing industry. You know, I just, that seemed, that was the thing that stood out to me about America's promise that, you know, we're with Africa in the future because Africa is going to be an important part on the global, an important player on the global stage or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? Like, yeah, to piggyback, like, to add on to that, cause I'd been, watching, and I mean, on Twitter, I'm in these like kind of cross like diaspora discussions with black people like globally, both on the continent and throughout the diaspora, and and I've been you know, watching some YouTube videos and interviews with like African experts, and one was a former head of former ambassador, Dr. Arikana Chiomboi Kwayo, and the reactions from continental Africans, and I actually want to emphasize this because I want to be very specific with my words, because I think sometimes people say like, oh, there's black people, then there's Africans, and I find it weird when black people say that, because I'm like, look, you're African too, you have African blood. So I want to be clear, there's African diasporans and there's continental Africans. That's continental Africans, people on the African continent, on African soil, and then there's African diaspora, the black diaspora, people of African descent living outside of the African continent. Like, we're all African in terms of like a shared ancestry and bloodline to the African continent, right? So I want to make that clear, because like, I feel like when people are like, oh, you're not a real African, you're a black American, like, well, where the fuck did the slave ships come from? Like, so some, like, I get tired of that shit, but anyway, I wanted to kind
also,
of clarify.
Also, like, why would you limit yourself to being American? I always thought that was silly. Why would you want to, like, if you have an out to not have to be totally American, why wouldn't you take it? But
and because also, like, I mean, other ethnic groups in the U.S., okay, yeah, they'll embrace America, the American flag and the, you know, citizenship and yada, 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 but, like, nobody denies, like, their fucking, like, ancestry and their roots like that. Like, not that completely. Like, yes, we've been in America for over 400 years because of the transatlantic slave trade. That's why we're here. This is the fact. But, like, that isn't, that's, to your point, Peter, about, like, you know, the our ties to Africa comes from, like, that's the land that we come from. I mean, the continent. Now, you know, and to be clear, like, African Americans, Jamaicans, we don't have direct continuity to specific ethnic groups in Africa, so that's where the distinction is, right? So, like, somebody who's, like, let's say from Nigeria, they're probably Yoruba, Igbo, they have, like, their name is Yoruba, Igbo, and, like, it goes down, like, multiple generations, right? Like, with African Americans, Jamaicans, Afro-Latinos, like, one, we're a mix of different African ethnic groups, and two, like, we don't, the main thing that we lost, one of the main things that we lost during slavery was our language. So that's one thing that, like, peoples have preserved their heritage is by their language. So, like, somebody who's Chinese American, they still have a Chinese last name. If they're Japanese American, they got a Japanese last name. They could be super fucking Americanized, speak like, you know, like a white American, standard American, you know, standard American English, yada yada yada. But, like, you know, through the language, their last name, like, okay, yeah, this person's Japanese or Chinese or Vietnamese because look at their last name, right? Somebody who's Italian, they got Italian last names. They could be, like, their people could have came here in, like, the 1850s or 1880s and, like, be super Americanized, but they're still Italian because they still have that connection right there, right? So we don't have, like, the language, the linguistic part that ties us directly to Africa, but we come from there. So I want to make that clear as I speak further on this. So, like, the reaction from continental Africans to this summit, it actually warmed my heart. It, like, gave me a little bit of hope, because from continental Africans, it was like, basically, it was like, a lot of them point out that the U.S.'s view of Africa for a long time has been so fucking cartoonish. Like, especially from, like, the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, the portrayal of Africa in the U.S. was like, children in poverty, is war-torn.
Right. Just child soldiers and AIDS.
Yeah, exactly. It was just AIDS, child soldiers, starving children, Black Hawk Down. Like, that was not just in media, but, like, at U.S. policymakers, like, their attitude toward Africa has always been that, oh, Africa needs aid. It needs to be, you know, taught how to do the rule of law and democracy because there's so much corruption. We need to save them. And a lot of Africans are like, look, you need to stop looking down at us like this. Like, there's a lot of what really gave me some hope was, like, this very straightforward, blunt reaction from continental Africans that, hey, look, we don't want you to fucking rescue us. Like, we have real problems here. You have to treat us with respect and dignity. And, yeah, there are quite a few who are saying, like, there should be African countries on, like, the UN Security Council and have, like, adequate representation on the international stage, which that makes a lot of fucking sense, because if you look at the international stage, Africa is always treated as, like, just like this backwater. Like, I'll give you a good example. I'll give you a really good fucking example. In 2011, the U.S. NATO intervention in Libya, right? The reaction from not just the U.S., but I hate to say it, even some Arabs toward Africa. Like, there was, like, this very, like, fucking anti-black sentiment I noticed from some North Africans. And I'm like, wait, Libya's... Look at a fucking map, dude. It's in fucking
Africa. You don't even have to go back that far. Just back to the World Cup, where there was still people trying to be like, yeah, I mean, yes, Morocco is in Africa. Because people would be like, Morocco, this one's for Africa. And they're like, yeah, Morocco is in Africa, but it's not African. You know what I'm saying?
It's not basically it's like North Africa's like, oh, well, the people there, they're not black. Like, yeah, right. We're North Africa. We're kind of lighter skin, but, like, some sort of Amazigh or, like, Arab. Like, the rest of them are just black. It's like, we're not African. We're not black. We're like those blacks over there. Like, I noticed that fucking reaction, like, during the fucking U.S. NATO intervention in Libya. Like, wait a minute. But here's the thing, like, Dr. Ari Khanna, I remember there was she was on a panel once, and she said that there were African heads of state around the time of the NATO intervention in Libya. Like, one of their proposals was that, like, hey, look, just we'll try Gaddafi in Africa. Like, we'll have a fair trial. Like, we'll deal with them. Because, which makes sense. Again, Libya's on African soil. But even in, like, left-wing circles, like, no one took that seriously. Like, oh, God, like, we can't trust Africa. Those African countries, like, they're all corrupt. They're all, like, blah, 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 blah. Like, the view in the U.S., not just the U.S. policymakers, but, like, even people on the left, the attitude toward Africa was, like, oh, it's just, like, this dark continent. It's all, like, blah, like, we need to rescue them. But what I found so refreshing was the voices of continental Africans saying, like, hey, look, we're not here to be fucking rescued. Stop looking down on us. We're tired of being disrespected by everybody else in the world. And especially when it comes to African countries, like their relationship, not just with Russia and China, but also Turkey, African countries are basically, the sense I get is basically like, you know what, we're sick of France, we're sick of the U.S., we're sick of these like white Western countries coming in here, lecturing us about democracy, the rule of law, all this other shit. We'll deal with China, we'll deal with Russia. Even like there's, look, I mean, China's not perfect in Africa, but the one thing that China gets right is that they don't lecture Africans about democracy and human rights and all that shit. Like, they don't, they're like, okay, we're here to do business, we'll build infrastructure, we'll build roads and stuff like that. Same with, like, you know, the Russians, they'll be like, okay, we'll, you know, supply, like, weapons and whatnot.
And, it's like, because then it's like, oh, no, they're doing debt-trapped diplomacy. Classic projection, guys, classic projection.
Right,
so
yeah.
You mean the thing the IMF has been doing since its inception and is its sole purpose. No, yeah, it's now a new problem that China's doing, when China is like, definitely more. China will write off a loan before saying you need to completely gut your education system,
right?
In order to like get more loans. Like the IMF, yeah. Like it's really hard to not say enough bad things about it. But yeah, it is, and I think like in the 90s, I mean, the Soviet Union was like the bulwark and in like the post-colonial era, and you know, look, there's plenty of things it did not do great in Africa. You know, it has there's plenty of room for criticism, but at least like it was something where like America had to I wouldn't say they acted correctly, but you could like internally in like the you know, in the imperial discussion chamber, like they're like, well, we have to do this in order, you know, or the Soviets, or, you know, Africa's going to go communist or whatever. But, you know, there was no countervailing force through the 90s and early 2000s. And so America could just like, you know, do the, you know, fucking commercial, like, I mean, you know what I'm talking about, like the Invisible Children commercials and stuff.
Oh, right, yeah, and or just, like the Kony 2012, all that. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, even like, just like NGOs could just run wild, and every idealistic little policy wonk could come up with their stupid little theory, and like, you know, Zappos could put a bunch of shoe manufacturers, Toms.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
That was the one where I was like, why don't Africans have shoes? I know, we'll give them shoes. And it's like, Africa couldn't make shoes. Well, now they can't because you're giving them for fucking free. Like, this was part of the problem. And now there's like slightly, it seems like there's, okay, well, at least we should, it is somewhat more useful to have like a local and national bourgeoisie empowered on the continent. Than just being a total vessel for government, for NGOs and entrepreneurs, because, you know, honestly, the less like entrepreneurial social activist types from America that get inspired to do something in Africa, the better, because there's really not much, like, you know, it's like people always like are going to have to build themselves up. Like that is the strategy, and it is good that the U.S. is saying, like, yeah, there's a rhetorical shift, but at the end of the day, their interest is resource extraction. They need those rare earth metals, baby.
Ding, ding, ding. Yeah,
they don't. Yeah. It's not, you know, like Rodney is very clear. Like, why would we make the cars and the phones in Africa? That's right. Our job. Right.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So that's you know, that's the way the world economy is set up.
And speaking on like I'll touch on the economy part, but like one thing I want to mention before I forget is another like major interest that the U.S. has in Africa is counterterrorism, particularly. I mean, because I mentioned, you know, the NATO U.S. NATO intervention in Libya, which actually like. the fallout from the war in Libya actually made terrorism, like it actually emboldened, like, some like, I guess you could say, like there's, like, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, right? They got empowered as a result of the fallout of the war in Libya, right? So, and a couple months ago, Biden, announced that the U.S. would be sending more troops, more special operations forces in Somalia. So the U.S. has military and counterterrorism interests in Africa. And that's also, like, been, like, one of the ways that, like, the U.S. has always is postured toward Africa. There we go. That's something that's also been part of the U.S.'s posture toward Africa, is through the rubric and the framework of counterterrorism and the war on terror. In that, like, since 9/11, in addition to the Arab world and the Middle East, like, from, you know, Iraq to Afghanistan and Pakistan, the Horn of Africa, and now, like, parts of the Sahel, had been part of, like, the U.S.'s global war on terror post 9/11. So, and also, I think in the last episode we talked about the U.S.'s war playbook, which is the expansion of proxy wars, and those are still going on in Africa. So, the U.S. Africa summit is also coming on the heels of the U.S. digging its military footprint further in Africa, and to the detriment of like the long-term well-being of Africa. But then going back to the economics part, like, yeah, Peter, you're absolutely right. Like, the U.S.'s main interest in Africa is resource extraction, and in addition to the military, it's going to need a military presence to secure that, right? So the military interest in the U.S., even though it's through, like, the rhetoric of counterterrorism, is also part of, like, its longer-term economic interest. And I think that's why the U.S. is concerned about Russia and China having relations with African countries, because I think the U.S. is looking at Africa. I would say, like, this is, like, a new scramble for Africa in the 21st century. Like, this is basically this. I think this is what we're seeing, and something that's important to mention. I would say really fucking important to mention, that is also mentioned in Rodney's book, is that, you know, the primary reason, I would say one of the primary reasons for Africa's underdevelopment, is the transatlantic slave trade. And Dr. Ari Khanna on Al Jazeera, she made this point that the first brain drain out of Africa started with this transatlantic slave trade, because the best and the brightest in Africa were taken out of Africa and brought to the Americas in chains. That was like that was one of the other damaging, long-term damaging effects of this, of the transatlantic slave trade, was that it was a giant brain drain. It was a massive extraction of quote unquote human capital out of Africa to,
not the literal humans as capital, but
right, yes, yeah, right, yeah, but like human people, like the right, skilled
workers and skilled, yeah, laborers who would have been better served, you know, developing the society that they came from.
Exactly.
Yes, those were, right, that, right, before the Berlin Conference came in and just steamrolled everything and just completely obliterated any local economy, so that all these idiots in Berlin and Paris who did cute little graphs about economics could justify how awesome free trade was, right? Like, the continent had already taken a number of body blows from the transatlantic slave trade, and you know, when it turned out that, like, formal colonialism wasn't really viable, especially after you had to enlist all these colonial subjects to go fight your wars in World War II, they're like, I'm sorry, we're gonna come back and do what now? I don't know about that. And also, like, yes, the lurking threat of communism, because communists were, like, the first people to actually really take decolonization seriously. I know sometimes you get fucking extreme like AP Gov weirdo types are like, no, Woodrow Wilson was all about it. Okay, yes, right. Woodrow Wilson, the guy who screened Birth of a Nation at the White House. He really was going to end colonialism anytime now. He's really going to give independence. No, like that was, it was understood by the 50s and 60s. Like, you know, obviously it took a lot of blood and a long time before it formally, you know, before formal colonialism ended, you know, and neocolonialism set in. And I think now they're trying to, like, it's, they're trying not to sound like they still just want to do neocolonialism. Like, I mean, I find the thing of, like, yeah, giving Africa, I mean, they're not, like, Africa's not going to get a veto power on the Security Council, but it is worth pointing out that, like, yeah, the Security Council were, like, the winning powers of World War II, and, like, yeah, the international governance structure is basically set up to, like, disempower the Third World, mostly, and, China was just, like, the lucky one grandfathered in, yeah, like, that stuff's gonna have to be rethought, and it is also still a little patronizing that, another promise by, first of all, also, yes, we'll believe it when we see it, like, this shit is, it sounds like, you know, and we can use this maybe to transition to the last segment, but it sounds like the same kind of promises Democrats make to black voters. Like, yeah, no, we're totally going to do this thing that will never happen. So cool. That's at least now they're making a better promise that they're never going to do. And it's like, okay, yeah, Africa, the African Union is going to be part of the G20, but like a permanent part of the G20. But like, is the European Union like a part of the G20? You know, right. Like, it still is like, okay, the whole continent is one country. Right. It's like I said, the Rhodesian vibes are still there. It's, America can't not be America, and it can't not really, like, if it's gonna try and help someone, it has to reshape it in its image. Like, that's just the only way America knows how to act in international relations. If it thinks it's going to help someone. Otherwise, like, it's just handling business, baby. It's just handling business, and just needs those rare earth metals to keep flowing, the uranium. I mean, yeah, that's the thing. It's like, counterterrorism and, like, neocolonialism go hand in hand, because it's like, yeah, the mines are like valuable targets, so of course you're going to need to protect them with your guys, because you can't trust the corrupt militaries who don't know how, who you have, unless you've trained them properly. So
I'll make my last point on the U.S. Africa summit, then transition, because another thing with Africa is like, there's a large youth population in Africa, like, particularly, you know, millennials and zoomers, and they want, like, I know there's some real fire among them, and I think what the U.S. is catching on to, that I think China and Russia already saw, and what Africans on the continent I think are making clear to the rest of the world, is that Africa has a lot of economic potential beyond just like a site of resource extraction, but like the potential for a rising middle class in Africa. And I think there is one segment on Al Jazeera, someone made this point that Africa right now, where it's at right now, is where China was 20 years ago, that there's, it has potential. And I think there's some truth to that. That I think, like, they're Africa.
Yeah, when it turns out, when you stop engineering wars and famines and plagues and depopulation strategies, like, economy can do pretty all right, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I think, like, especially, and actually, this will be my segue into the next topic. One thing I've been noticing with the back and forth across like the African diaspora is that I think there's a hunger both among Africans on the continent and Africans in the diaspora to really reclaim our history and understand our heritage more. And I think like some of the diaspora wars that you see online, which oftentimes I think are incredibly petty and don't really represent the day-to-day interaction between diasporans and continentals. But I think like what those sort of tensions reveal is that I think like a real identity crisis among Africans on the continent and Africans in the diaspora in terms of understanding, truly understanding who we really are as a people and understanding our shared collective fate. And I think reclaiming our heritage that's been completely like attacked by both slavery and colonization. And I think this will segue perfectly into Black America's attitude toward the Democratic Party, because there is an article in the New York Times that got published last November, on November 30th. The headline is, Black turnouts in midterms was one of the low points for Democrats. And basically, so this is about the 2022 midterms. And what it's talking about, what it observed and like what data has shown is that there's been low Black voter turnout in the post-Obama era. So it says, because with the midterms, like I mean, there are a lot of people who are like Democrats, liberals, and even some leftists who are kind of like dancing on the kind of proverbial grave of Republicans because there wasn't this massive like red tide that occurred. But I personally don't think it's a good look that Republicans took control of the House. I mean, yeah, Democrats have control of the Senate and the White House, but Republicans getting control of the House when, like, that's not good. But anyway, what this article says is that as more data becomes final, it's clear that Black turnout is not one of those feel-good stories for the party. We won't get conclusive numbers for months, but the evidence so far raises the distinct possibility that the Black share of the electorate sank to its lowest level since 2006. It certainly did in states like Georgia and North Carolina, where authoritative data is already available. The relatively low turnout numbers aren't necessarily a surprise. After all, this was not supposed to be a good year for Democrats. Perhaps this is one of the things that went about as expected, with no reason to think it portends catastrophe for Democrats in the years ahead. Still, relatively low Black turnout is becoming an unmistakable trend in the post-Obama era, raising important, if yet unanswered, questions about how Democrats can revitalize the enthusiasm of their strongest group of supporters. Is it simply a return to the pre-Obama norm? Is it yet another symptom of eroding Democratic strength among working-class voters of all races and ethnicities? Or is it a byproduct of something more specific to Black voters, like the rise of a more progressive activist and pessimistic Black left that doubts whether the Democratic Party can combat white supremacy? Whatever the answer, it is clear that the relatively low Black turnout was not exactly disastrous electorally for Democrats in 2002. With the possible high exception of the Wisconsin Senate race, it's hard to identify a high-profile election where Democrats might have prevailed if the Black share of the electorate had stayed at 2014 or 2018 levels. But it does make sense of one of the stranger features of this election, how Republicans fared so well the national vote, but routinely underperform in critical states and districts. And then it goes on. I mean, with kind of the numbers, I don't want to go through all that, but I'll put the article in the show notes. And even in Axios, mentioned, this is actually earlier this month, midterm surprise, low Black voter turnout. It says a record number of Black Democrats ran for Senate in battleground states during the 2002 midterm elections, but many of them failed to energize African-American voters. Why it matters, one of the most important stories in American politics is the Democratic Party's increasing reliance on white voters as they lose ground with non-white voters. So it goes through that, but there's also this really good I like to go on Pew Research Center. This is where I look for kind of more data type stuff. Like, it's really good to get like polling data and like for specific like ethnic groups, and Pew Research does a lot of good stuff. But there is one thing that it had this report, this article that came out in August that said Black Americans have a clear vision for reducing racism, but little hope it will happen. And in one of the sections, it said Black Americans are pessimistic about their position in society. And it also said Black Americans see little improvement in their lives despite increased national attention to racial issues. Few Black adults expect equality for Black people in the U.S. Roughly 1 in 10 Black adults say equality for Black people in the U.S. is extremely or very unlikely. They also say racism and police brutality are extremely big problems. And also, like, if one thing it mentioned, this Pew Research Center report mentioned that that basically, like, it says Black adults say racism in our laws is a bigger problem than racism by individual people. So I wanted to bring this up because I think, like, the jadedness, the pessimism from Black America toward the U.S. is kind of similar to the attitude I was noticing among continental Africans toward the West, that, like, continental Africans are becoming much more distrustful and pessimistic with dealing, I would say, with the West in general, because, I mean, there's a lot of, like, just, like, okay, what the fuck is the U.S. going to do for us in Africa? But when you look at, like, a lot of Africans' view of France, like, particularly in, like, Mali and Burkina Faso, they're, like, they're basically telling France to eat shit, which I love to see. Like, yeah, fuck. I mean, this is... Yes, this is
a strong anti-France podcast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, it's interesting to see that I think within, like, Black people around the world, what I think is interesting to note is, like, I think there's a heightened kind of, like, new consciousness, I think, when it comes to identifying our problems clearly, in terms of, like, reaching, like, larger and larger, like, numbers among the masses of Black people globally. And within the U.S. context, what's clear is that Black Americans are much more pessimistic about where we're at in society. And this is despite, like, the advancements of civil rights legislation in post-60s and the election of Obama. And I think this is a generational thing, because the Black people who were strongly pro-Democrat, who were the most reliably Democratic voters, were the boomers, the Black people who were alive during the civil rights movement. And a lot of them are getting older and they're dying. I mean, my mom was a boomer. She was of that generation. So,
I mean, for the people who grew up with memories of de jure segregation, like, Obama was, like, a very significant achievement in their lives. Being elected, you know, for our generation, it is less so, and it is just like, yeah, the Democratic Party just says they're gonna do a bunch of shit that they don't do, and they say they care and they don't, and you know, like, like post George Floyd protests, it's like, okay, there is all this you know, awareness and, like, commitment to DEI and all this crap. And, you know, you're right. And, okay, there's more representation, more Black people running for office. That's great. But, like, it's been interesting being back in the city I grew up in and seeing which parts have changed and which parts have not. And there's a whole lot of development and investment in parts of Columbus and suburbs, and there are, you know, and you can guess which people live there, because Columbus is already a very segregated city. And there's also, like, parts that haven't fucking changed since the 90s. And, like, it's crazy, you know, And in those areas, like, it's a security state. Like, you know, every place, like, all the libraries have security guards. Like, every, I don't know, it's just, like, there's, it's a security state. I mean, Columbus police are just fucking insane. You know, the news just is all crime, and it's like, yeah, you know, in actually existing Black America, not like the one that's on TV or like in the discussion halls of, you know, academies, like, shit isn't necessarily, like, shit hasn't really gotten better. Like, it's tied to, I don't want to say that, like, there's been no improvement since the 90s, because I think that there is a heightened awareness. I think there is a heightened awareness of, like, building each other up, and, like, I think there is less nihilism sort of inherently, but I think that it is true that there is a more sober understanding that, like, we're the only ones who are going to, like, get ourselves out of this, whatever it is, because, like, like, if you take the long view of history of America, like, there's always a bunch of other shit going on that white people are doing, and then, like, the Negro problem, quote unquote, is just a thing that, like, some of them care about more than others, and, you know, sometimes bubbles up, and they're like, oh, what do you want us to do? Oh, well, that's asking too much. And so then they go back to forgetting about it. And that's, like, that is the trend of American history. So, like, it gets to a point where it's like, I don't really, you know, yes, there have been advances in, you know, enfranchisement and legal rights, but the central function of race in America, you know, as a, like, you know, as a superstructure for the economic function, like, it's still there, in a way, like, I don't know, it has confirmed to me that, like, whiteness still is the engine that drives America, and that there really isn't, you know, everything else is just a gesture, it's a gesture to, you know, from the guilty conscience of liberals, and, you know, perhaps a more enlightened view that, like, pure repression, like, is more likely to end bloodily, and that, like, a fine, you know, little more skilled hand at a statecraft or whatever, like, can, you know, prevent the whole thing from crashing down, but ultimately, it's whiteness that powers a thing, and, it, you know, it's continuing that way, and, like, you know, we're, like, whatever the right's doing, like, it is, like, we are entering a reactionary period, that's, it just seems obvious to me, and I don't want to get all fear-mongery about it, but, like, it still is, like, American identity is white, like, America is still a white country, it's why it is the way it is, because it needed to preserve whiteness, like, in a way that made it, you know, is a white settler population, like, in a way that made whiteness, like, if you bought into it, then, you know, enough of you were able to transcend the feudal cycles of poverty from Europe. And, you know, obviously there are plenty of poor white people, but those are the ones that were just doing whiteness wrong. That's why they're called white trash or whatever. But, you know, you can make up for it by just making them enough of them super racist. And they'll go along with it. And, you know, though, honestly, poor white people, I always see them as collateral damage for keeping black people in their place, is the way this thing kind of actually operates. So, you know, as long, like, that's, I don't know, that's just America. That's what it is. That's how it operates. And, you know, people understand that if they're paying attention. And so, I don't know, you know, yeah, it's, I mean, even the Tariq Nasheed types, you know, the Hoteps or the Israelites or whatever, they're not gonna go Republican because they know that the Republican Party still hates them.
Right. Just to interject, because I think what you said about the Republicans, I actually want to chime in on that because one thing I've noticed from some, like, I don't know, some activists or pundits or some people on social media, some people have, like, expressed alarmism or concern that there could be black people turning Republican or, like, black men turning Republican. But I think actually what this data shows is that the real thing that, like, that I guess if people are concerned about the future of the Democratic Party, right, and its ability to reach non-white voters, when it comes to black voters, I don't think they should be concerned about large numbers of black voters turning Republican en masse. I mean, there have always been black conservatives. They've always existed, right? But they've always been a minority, and there are black people with, like, I guess you could say, socially conservative views, like when it comes to, you know, maybe like abortion or even like some like gender identity issues. Like there's always like those types of black people who have,
overstated.
Yeah, it's overstated, but like, I mean, they exist. But my point is that that even though that, like, there are black people with those, like, kind of, I would say, like, culturally traditionalist views when it comes to certain issues, when you actually, like, pull their views on, let's say, police brutality, economics, things of that sort, there's major divergence from, like, what the Republican Party is offering. So I think what this data shows, and I think what, if people know anything about, like, I think black voters and black people in general, is that I think, like, if the, what one should expect is that there are more black people who are just going to drop out of electoral politics and gender, in general, i.e. not vote, just not show up to the polls. I think that's much more likely because, especially when we're talking about our generation, millennials, and then Generation Z right after is Zoomers, like, millennials and black millennials and black Zoomers are not Republican leaning in terms of politics, right? Our views, for the most part, tend to be much more, like, progressive and further left. I would say further left than boomers, and definitely further left than the black Gen X generation. So when it comes to, like, the future voting population.
I mean, the social questions are, like, overall settled, I think even among people, in especially like Gen Z people who don't imagine themselves as on the left, they are not really like anti, like, the wedge issues of the 2000s aren't going to be as effective because it is, you know, that's why they have to go into the weird groomer territory with this shit, because, like, the old stuff, it doesn't really work. And yeah, like, everyone can see that the Republican Party is just becoming completely deranged. And so, yeah, the Republican Party is ontologically incapable of actually competing for black votes because its main project is selling white resentment.
Right, exactly,
so,
yeah.
So that, yeah, like, that's how its operation stays afloat. So it can't, it, like, literally just can't.
Because the Republican Party right now is more overtly white nationalist. Like, the Republican Party, like, the Trump's presidency basically, like, took the mask off of the Republican Party and showed its true colors, which it is the party of white nationalism, it's the party of white aggrievement, and the party of, like, white resentment. That's the Republican Party. So you can't have a party that's completely devoted to that project and draw in large numbers of black voters at the same time, because it would fall apart, right? And Republicans know this. And I think, like, Republicans, I don't think they really care about reaching out to black voters in general. Like, I mean, they'll bring in a few who like will echo their talking points, and basically to be a black person in the Republican Party and to kind of get along in that crowd, you pretty much have to completely disavow black America in general and pretty much echo all of like their anti-black talking points. That's what Candace Owens, that's her job, is basically to be like the black puppet for like
yeah.
the black
yeah
the
I mean
black
there's muscle. Always going to be a few of those people that yeah. will, that can be bought off because yeah. they just want a career that bad yeah. they like feeling special or whatever yeah but yeah in terms of like a voting populace, like it just they know that they don't care because yeah. that's not what they're doing. And so I don't know, it seems like that only gets brought up as a specter when you know they're like they need to pathologize. There hasn't been a proper pathologization of black men in the news cycle for, you know, like 6 weeks. I think that's probably about, I don't know, 6 to 8 weeks is probably about how long we need a new one. So that was one that they had to do. But also yeah. because, you know, when the Democratic Party is really out of every actual reason to vote for it, they'll say, well, you know, they just want to demoralize you into not voting. And so you should. So not voting is just the same as voting for them, which like is just not how anything works in the world ever.
And when people say that, they're like, oh, like if you don't vote at all, that's the same as voting Republican. Okay, does it work for the other side? Because I never hear it where it's like they tell like somebody with conservative views who doesn't vote, they're like, hey, if you don't vote Republican, you're helping the Democrats. Like, I never hear it in that direction. It's always like used to kind of discipline people who are rightfully pissed off at the Democratic Party, who have like progressive liberal to like, you know, left wing or left of center views. I've always heard it when it comes to like basically disciplining those people to vote Democrat unconditionally. And this is another thing is that Democrats are used to having black people vote for the Democrats unconditionally. And what I think the low black voter turnout is basically saying, like, hey, look, if you want our vote, we need something in return. It's not like you just whip us out every 2 to 4 years as like, you know, and whip out the black community to go vote for you just to use our numbers. And then when you're actually in office, you don't do anything. You don't pass like any specific legislation or policy that's targeted to the specific interests and needs of the black community. And that's what like more and more black people I'm noticing are saying in black political spaces, is that like they're not like pro-Republican. It's more like we're sick of being taken advantage of by the Democratic Party, because of black America's like percentage as a large ethnic minority population, and the fact that you know, we vote Democrat in such large percentages. The Democrats, in terms of numbers, have always relied on like, okay, black people are going to be loyal to us, so you know, we have them, you know, we have them. And also like what Joe Biden was saying during the 2020 election is that like, hey, you guys got nowhere to go, right? You can't
right.
vote
he,
Republican.
Yeah, you know, at least he came out and said it. Also,
yeah.
I mean, I think it is all like, there are definitely a lot of the mechanics of the Democratic Party machine are leftovers like from the Great Migration, where there were you know, concentrated black neighborhoods that had their own political machines that were, you know, incorporated into the larger political machine, the Democratic Party in northern cities. There is like a a lot of black people are moving back to the South. You know, this is why like Georgia was supposed to got flipped or whatever. But they're moving into places that the Democrats have basically given up on competing for. So like they, yeah, you know, In terms of the way I think the Democratic Party even understood how the black vote functions, like that, like the, yeah, the material conditions of that are changing, alongside just the fact that, you know, because they're very, you know, what the Democratic Party is very good at is recruiting, like, the cadre, and there are a lot of Black families for whom, like, Democratic Party politics is just the family business, like,
right, yeah.
You know, it was an opportunity, like, politics was one of the few things where there's an opportunity for advancement, and it's, the Democratic Party is still good at that, but for people for whom politics is not the family business, or isn't a career, like, they ain't got nothing for them, so.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm not one of those people who is particularly concerned about the Democratic Party. I will say, I'll say this, and then I'll make my last point to wrap this up. Like I said, I'm not really particularly concerned about the future of the Democratic Party. But I do think, like, because regarding, like, non-white voters, I do think that the ethnic group that more likely could turn Republican in larger numbers are Latino voters, because I think, like, what is hopefully more and more people are becoming aware of this is that, like, I mean, obviously, yeah, if we want to bring up the ethnic study stuff, Latino is technically not a race. You can be, you know, a white Latino, a brown indigenous Latino, or a black Latino, right? So, like, I think in the same way that, like, Democrats have had, I think, have done a similarly shitty job of engaging Latino voters, in that, like they don't really engage Latino vote, like, in a way that's, like, I think, remotely serious. And I noticed a lot of Latinos will point that out, that, like, hey, look, like, we have other issues besides just, like, you know, immigration. And I mean, especially living here in California, when it comes to immigration, not all Latinos are technically immigrants. Many are born in the U.S. I mean, they'll go back and forth to Mexico or Central America, you know, to stay in touch with family and culture. But there are a lot of Latinos in the U.S. who were born in the U.S. or, like, they were raised in the U.S. for most of their lives. And so for some of them, like, immigration isn't, like, the only issue that they're concerned about. And you know, there is a whole shit with the fucking LA City Council with the racist shit that fucking Nuri Martinez and all those fucking idiots said, and Kevin DeLeon, that I don't want to go too much into that, but I think, like, what's one thing that that showed, I think, of the way that the community in LA responded to it, is that, like, I know in LA, in the Bay Area, the relation between blacks and Latinos is a little bit different. It's always been a little more amicable, because I'll say it's from a Bay Area perspective, that the relation between blacks and particularly Mexicans has largely stemmed from, like, U.S. born Latinos and Mexicans living in similar low-income areas as black people, and it builds this sense of at times, like, a shared sense of, like, hey, wait a second, we're facing the same issues when it comes to education, being in low performing schools, poverty, even mass incarceration, right? So, and then, yeah, you have, like, you know, white Latinos who can more easily assimilate into white America, even if they have, like, a Spanish last name, like, hey, they can kind of, you know, they're not gonna be face the heavy handedness of systemic racism that, like, darker skinned Latinos would face, right? So, in LA, I know, like, there's long been tensions between blacks and Latinos, but in recent years, like, they've resolved a lot of that stuff. And so what I want to get at is that, like, when it comes to, like, black and brown politics, and even, you know, putting aside some of the, I think there's a lot of issues that need to be ironed out, particularly when it comes to anti-blackness. But on a political, speaking, when it comes to politics and issues, when you put aside just, like, Democrats seeing, like, Latinos, it's like, oh, you're all like these poor immigrants we have to rescue, and like, yeah, we're not racist like Republicans are. We love like Mexican food in our neighborhoods. Like, there's actually real fucking issues, like shit, like
right.
I was saying, yeah.
The Democrats can't do anything about.
Right. Yeah. Like shit. Yeah. Exactly. Like the effects of neoliberalism that Democrats are responsible for, that impact Black people, also impact other like non-white ethnic groups, particularly in low-income working class communities. So there's also those issues as well that like Latinos and Black Americans share in the U.S. And I'm talking about specifically on issues, systematic issues like policing, education, jobs, wages, things of that sort. But yeah, the Democrats aren't gonna address that. But my point in bringing it up is that, like, you know, I can see, like, not all, but like more Latinos. I think there's some data showing like there are more Latinos like going Republican. I mean, hell, there's a group called Latinos for Trump, which shocked a lot of people, and I've heard stories.
Well, it only shocks like white liberals because they don't really get that, like,
right.
A lot of Mexicans hate immigrants. Like,
yeah, yeah.
The ones that have, you know, been here for a while, they don't like the new ones. A lot of them, and a lot of them aren't. You know, they're not all farm workers and mechanics. There's like a petty bourgeois strata too. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that like are going more towards the Republican Party. Like, yeah. to be very clear.
Yeah.
Because I know that a lot of times it's like, well, you know, they're socially conservative, so that's just what they do, you know. But, you know, because machismo or whatever. And it's like, no, like that, is who, you know, it's still class politics at the end of the day. We can't really acknowledge that except for the white working class, which gets like carved out as the special exception. Instead, we like to do race politics science, politics, like race science as politics, as political science. That's our cute little nerd hobby, for AP Gov nerd wonks out there. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, like, the fucking liberals are so concerned about this, but the Democratic Party machine never, like, kind of had the same sort of lockstep, you know. It wasn't as in lockstep because, like, the Civil Rights Movement was such a galvanizing event, and also that it created, like, that political class. It created a new political class. In the Black community. You know, Cesar Chavez was a union organizer, and it, you know, that was just in California, like in Texas and Florida and, you know, everywhere else, New Mexico and Arizona, like, that isn't, like, that's not the same machine and stuff. So,
oh, yeah, yeah.
So that's why, like, those votes are a little more up for grabs. And demographics, it's not destiny Democrats. You have to actually do shit.
So. Yeah, and also, like, touching upon, like, class, and I think I mentioned this in the bonus episode, but since this is a free episode, I thought I'd mention this, especially when it comes to, like, race, politics, Black, Latino voters. Like, Latin America, especially since we mentioned slavery as well, I mean, Latin America has its own history of slavery. Like, it was a site of the transatlantic slave trade. Spain, the Spanish Empire, benefited immensely from the transatlantic slave trade. And so that's why there are so many Black people in Latin America. I mean, the region, some of the countries that stick out the most are, like, I mean, Dominican Republic, Cuba, even though technically Puerto Rico is not a country. I mean, we see it as its own, like, independent nation. So, I mean, yeah, Puerto Rico, and then, like, now this is more like Central South America, like Panama, Colombia, Venezuela. Brazil is often thrown in as a Latin American country, even though the people there speak Portuguese. So Latin America has its own history of slavery, anti-Blackness, and colonialism. But the way that race was structured in Latin America was slightly different than in the U.S. So they had a called a casta system. And so basically, like when the Spanish came to, when the Spanish and Portuguese came to the Americas, it was initially the men. And so when it came time to having children, they had their way with indigenous women. And then as they brought slaves over from Africa, like African women. And, you know, these relationships were not always consensual because these are often like, you know, mistresses and concubines. And so the population as a group became more mixed. And the Catholic Church and the Spanish Crown, like, they didn't want to sanction all these, like, these basically illegitimate kids of Spanish men. And so then they brought over more women, and they instituted this, yeah, called the casta system, which basically, it was to concentrate wealth, power, and privilege in the hands of people who were white, i.e. people who were pure Spanish blood. They're the people who were like who were running the Spanish Empire at the time. And then when, and then you, then yeah, you had like the people born in Spain, the Peninsulares, and then the Spanish people born in, Spanish blood people born in the Americas, the Criollos. Then the mestizos, who are half Spanish, half indigenous. Then mulattoes, half African, half Spanish. Then there's native people. Then there are black people. And then there's like black native people. So after Spain got, you know, those countries got independent, gave their independence from Spain, the hierarchy still remained the same. So like if you look at like, you know, a lot of Spanish like soap operas and media, or not even put aside the media, look at all, like if you look at the heads of state and the people who are government administrators in Latin American countries, they all look a certain way. They all look pretty white. And Argentina after World War II brought a lot of like Nazis, former Nazis, and welcomed them. That's why there's a lot of people in South America with German last names. There's a reason that's the reason why. So so yeah, like that's why you can have like white Latinos, because yeah, they have European blood. They're white. I mean, they're not Scandinavian or like they're not like the Scots, Irish, Anglo-Saxon whites that came to the U.S. But you know, they're white. Yeah, maybe some of them get a tan or whatever because Spain's on the fucking Mediterranean. Got it. But you know, so so I wanted
they're darker because of the Moors. And and this is relevant because of like there's also the, like in it, like there are more Colombians. Colombians are a growing segment, mm-hmm. and also like the Venezuelans who you know fled the horrors of Chavismo. I mean, like fled the economic war that America inflicted on Venezuela to make sure that country didn't succeed. So those are, you know, though many of them have more of that like South American kind of very continental mentality, and though and they are more likely to, a lot of them are more likely to end up in the Republican Party, and of course obviously like a lot of Miami, a lot of Cubans in Florida as well. So
yeah, actually, and actually white Cubans when they came to the U.S. in the 60s, it was very easy for them to like own businesses and basically, yeah, like basically, you know, move up economically while black Americans couldn't, and things were still segregated. So, and black Cubans who came here, yeah, were, got treated the same way under Jim Crow as black Americans. But, yeah, the petty bourgeoisie of like white Cubans in Miami, they some of them got government benefits too. So so yeah, like, so that's why, like, I mean, people like fucking Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, I mean, they're in the Republican Party for that reason, because I mean, in addition to them being incredibly anti-communist, America basically welcomed them with open arms and gave them opportunities to move up economically, opportunities that were denied to black Americans. So yeah, so I wanted to mention that because like when it comes to Democrats and how they engage like different ethnic groups. I think those sorts of nuances had to be understood, because I do think that, like, and I think that, I know there's like more data to show this, that like I think there's more data to show this. I'd have to look more into it, but I think there's legitimate cause for concern of more Latinos voting Republican, even though, to be clear, most Latinos vote Democrat, but I don't know.
It's at like a 70% level and not like the 90% level of Black people.
Yeah, and so I do think, though, that I don't know how long that that Latinos will remain so staunchly Democrat like that. I know what Black voters, the solution, what Black voters are doing is just not voting at all. With Latinos, I think there will be some who don't vote and some who will turn Republican. But I think, particularly to close out and just make this final point, when it comes to the Democratic Party and Black voters, I'm not really concerned about the future of the Democratic Party, but I do think that I actually take the low Black voter turnout as a good sign, which seems weird, but the reason why I take it as a good sign is that it would basically be us showing collectively that hey, look, you know what, if this system's not going to do anything for us, then we're not going to vote, and there will be consequences to it. And so that means, I think it would give Black America a little more leverage when it comes to dealing with, I would say, both parties, both Democrats and Republicans. They would have to, like, basically the Democratic Party in particular would have to take Black voters much more seriously, that, like, okay, we can't just, it would show to the Democrats that they can't take Black voters for granted and just think that that Black people are just going to vote lockstep unconditionally. And so I actually think that the low Black voter turnout politically would empower us. It would hurt the Democrats, but I actually think that that's a good thing, that the Democrats do need, like, you know, to basically, you know, have their fire to the ass, have their ass to the fire a little bit.
Yeah. It is hard to say whether or not there's like an intentional strategy or it's just like a longer term trend, but I also do feel generally the same way that, like, there isn't really an option left. You can't, you know, it's like, it's a toxic relationship. Like, you can't keep running back to someone who doesn't respect you, that tells you they care, and then goes around and, like, does the same shit as the people that they need you afraid of. Like, it's really about getting over the fear of Republicans, because that's the primary disciplinary mechanism. And I don't think, like, as necessarily a coerce as, like, I don't think it'll work to coerce the Democrats in the sense that, like, because as, like, the electorate's gonna shrink, and the fucking geniuses that run electoral campaigns, they just see, like, non-voters as a set category and voters as a set category, and they don't care about the non-voters because they don't vote. So they're just competing for the, you know, Bernie was the only campaign recent member that actually tried to increase the size of the electorate, and you know, since he didn't become president, the genius political consultants aren't going to see that as possible. So they are, like, just increasingly fighting over a smaller amount. And this is why, like, it's always like, there's no real swing voters. Like, you meet very few of them. They are, like, honestly, they're, like, the biggest snowflakes in the world. They just love attention. But those are the only people that, like, people that run electoral campaigns know how to, like, fight over. And so, I would love the idea that, like, once Democrats realize that, like, they're not getting, like, more Black people to vote for them, they're gonna start taking reparations seriously. I also think that, like, it's, you know, what will more likely happen is that they're just gonna focus on fighting over the suburbs, and they're, you know, most of the people that get paid to talk about elections on TV are very clear that that's the Democrat strategy. in the future is fighting for the suburbs, because that's, I guess, the only place that's up for grabs is, like, white suburban, you know, middle-class petty bourgeois voters. So, you know, but I suppose the upside about getting people to break out of the Democratic Party, I'm not going to say cage or anything like that, but getting able to break free from the fear cycle of voting out of fear of the Republicans is that maybe we can actually figure out how to organize ourselves politically for our own ends. And I think that's a good note to end on.
Because
we're at an hour 30, so.
Yeah. The only last thing I'll say to, to wrap up and then, kind of like looking forward to 2023, the reason why that kind of organizing is going to be important is because, the Fed has raised interest rates, and, I was reading, something on my phone. I get like these fucking like news notifications on my phone, and it was saying that like there are a lot of economists are predicting that a lot of economists and analysts are saying there's going to be a recession in 2023, and in the first couple months of 2023 Americans are going to feel it the worst. And there is a fucking article in the Washington Post. The editorial board said, to beat inflation, the Fed might have to trigger a recession. So, the ruling class is just going to keep breaking the backs of the working class. And that's something to look forward to for 2023. And I think, by disengaging from the mainstream electoral politics and focusing on, like, real organizing on the ground, that's necessary. I mean, it's beyond necessary at this point, especially looking at 2023 coming up and a recession being very likely. And people are already hurting with inflation. That's going to be needed. We're going to need that. And
We're going to have lots of content.
So that wraps up this episode. If you like this episode and you want to hear our bonus content, become a patron at patreon.com/realsankarhours. Again, patreon.com/realsankarhours. $5 a month gets you bonus content. $3 a month, no bonus content, but you'll be supporting the work we do here at Real Sankar Hours, because especially as, you know, things get worse, we believe that we strongly believe in the kind of political education and media that we're doing to raise consciousness and give people the political tools that they need to fight back. Cause things are not looking good. And so, we're doing this as part of the struggle. So to support what we're doing, become a patron, patreon.com/realsankarhours. And also, like I said at the beginning of the episode, we have a Discord server, so join our Discord and hopefully can build some great community. And who knows, like, maybe through the Discord you might link up with people who might be in your community and you can organize together. Who knows? But anyway, all right, so time to sign out. Keep the faith.
Stay dangerous.
All right, peace.
See ya.